My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Are you afraid of flying? Does the thought of driving through a tunnel frighten you? What about getting into an elevator, being in a small confined space, or even exploring your closets? Are there situations that cause you panic, anxiety, claustrophobia, and dread? If so, you are one of the estimated 6 million Americans who suffer from panic disorder. You may have sought relief from psychotherapy and even medications, only to find that these did not alleviate your symptoms. Is there another way of approaching this debilitating problem and opening your life to fully experiencing everything it has to offer? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Captain Tom Bunn, says that there is, and you can achieve this in just 10 days without drugs or doctors. Tom Bunn is a licensed therapist and a regular contributor to Psychology Today. He's a former U.S. Air Force captain who flew the Air Force's first supersonic jet fighter, the F-100. Following his service, he was an airline pilot, during which time he began examining and addressing flight panic. His further work and research led him to a greater understanding of the neuromechanisms of panic and anxiety and the development of his program. His website is panicfree.net, and he joins me this week to discuss his new book, Panic Free, the 10-Day Program to End Panic, Anxiety, and Claustrophobia. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Captain Tom Bunn. Captain Tom, thank you so much for your service then and now.
Thank you so much, Victor. This is a great opportunity to get the word out that if you haven't gotten a good solution for panic before, we have one that you can build in. It'll work automatically for you.
Now, please share with our listeners about your personal path and how you became interested in those who had a fear of flying.
Well, we had a course at Pan Am, started by another pilot. He had a couple of friends who were afraid of flying. He worked with them individually and got it going. So he went to the authorities at Miami, where he was based, and talked them into starting a program. So this was one of the first fear of flying programs. The other one, the early one, was at US Air. I worked with him as a volunteer for a while, and although it was a groundbreaking program, it still left people in trouble who were troubled by panic, because they would get on the plane and do the breathing exercises that we told them would help them deal with their anxiety. Sure, it will help with anxiety, but panic's another thing. And so they were on what we call the graduation flight and doing the breathing exercises we taught them and having a full-blown panic attack, so it was not a pretty sight. I suggested we added cognitive behavioral therapy to the mix, and it never happened, so I set up my own program and added it, thinking that was going to fix it. But there was a problem with cognitive behavioral therapy that I didn't foresee, and that is, it's cognitive. And when a person is in a state of panic, they don't have much cognition available to do cognitive tools with. So it became obvious that we needed to find some way that would work automatically. See, if a person can't deploy these tools when they need them because of being overloaded, being overwhelmed in panic, we need to do something that will work automatically for them.
Now, I have to ask, you obviously were a wonderful pilot in the Air Force and a pilot for the airlines. Did you ever personally experience any of these fears yourself?
Well, funny enough, I had a panic attack on my first solo flight. In training, you go up with your instructor for 6, 7, or 8 flights, and then they let you loose on your own. And for those first 8 flights that I had an instructor who was he was as abusive as anybody I've ever met before or since. And so for the entire flight, every time I was flying with him on those first 8 flights, all he did was just yell and scream at me about how terrible I was doing. Sometimes he would say, "What the hell are you trying to do? Kill us?" Things like that. So I did not get the idea that I knew what I was doing. And so one day he just out of the blue said, "Okay, you go up and fly the plane and come in." And he gave me some instructions to do some aileron rolls and barrel rolls and some stall series. And then he said, "Fly around and do something 20 minutes that you want to do and then come in and land." So he walked away from the plane, and I was still thinking kind of on autopilot, sort of like a hypnotized. But I simply did those steps he told me to do. I took off. I went up and did those maneuvers he told me to do. But then I ran into a problem because you remember he said, "Fly around for 20 minutes, do something you want to do." That wasn't in the script what to do for 20 minutes. And suddenly I had the realization, oh my goodness, I've got to land this plane and I don't know how, because he told me I didn't know how for so long. And so there was a moment of panic, but I couldn't indulge in it because I figured even though I don't know how to land the plane, I'm the only person on the plane who knows anything about it, so I have to give it a try. So I think there's an advantage when you have to push through it, that it doesn't I think there's a big difference if you have a panic attack and you back off and you escape versus if you have a panic attack and you are forced to deal with it. Then
So having had this experience personally, you had a vested interest in helping those who also had that experience.
Well, you know, I really didn't think much about it after that. It only came to mind when a client would say, "Well, have you ever had a panic attack?" And originally I thought no, but then I realized, yeah, that was a panic attack. I thought I was trapped. I thought my life was over and there was no way out. And those are the two things that you have in panic. You think it's a life-threatening situation, there's no escape.
So you had your background in the Air Force, and you served as a pilot with the airlines, and then you chose a new career and a new way of life, really, in therapy. Tell us how that transitioned for you.
Well, yes, you see, from a pilot's point of view, you think that if people just understand how safe flying is, that's all they need. That's not the ball game. The problem is that anytime you're in a situation where you're not in control, you may not be able to regulate yourself. And if you can't regulate yourself, then you say, "Well, I don't like the way this situation is going. I need to get out of here." So the problem with being on an airplane for a person who's afraid to fly is they're afraid they're going to have a panic attack, and that they are not going to be able to get out of the plane to get relief from the panic attack. And they might be in a state of panic for hours. So that keeps them off the plane. So what we had to do was to find a way that, instead of trying to say, "When you panic, do this," because that's not going to work, we had to have them rehearse a set of steps that would be built inside in a part of the brain that we call unconscious procedural memory. Let me just kind of tell you what that is. Anybody who drives a car, if you remember when you first drove a car, how difficult it was, now you can drive a car and have a conversation with someone. Your car is being driven kind of on mental autopilot. So what we need to do is to take the steps that will protect a person from panic and build them into that same part of the brain that you use to drive your car for you, so that when they are in a situation where they might have panic, they're on mental autopilot to protect themselves from it.
Now, in your work in school and getting trained and becoming a therapist and a licensed social worker and therapist, was any of that addressed in your years in school?
Well, we learned mainly cognitive behavioral therapy, but I also studied Gestalt therapy and neurolinguistic programming because I kept trying to find something that would fix this and didn't. So no, I couldn't find anything in the institutes that I went to, in addition to graduate school, and I did not find a solution to this.
Now, according to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, 6 million Americans have panic disorder, and an estimated 4.7% of U.S. adults experience panic attacks at some time in their life. Only one person in seven treated using cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is the most commonly used psychotherapy, becomes panic-free. You briefly touched on this before. What is CBT, and why does this therapy not work for most who receive it?
Well, CBT is a really good therapy. It's called cognitive behavioral therapy. The idea is that a lot of our mental distress comes from irrational thoughts or thoughts that we don't have in good balance within ourselves. Or it could be conflicts that we could bring out and give them the light of day and work them out. Because the idea is what you think has a lot to do with your feelings. So if you're having bad feelings, maybe you're having some thoughts that could be improved. So that's cognitive in a nutshell. The idea is that in terms of anxiety on an airplane, your feelings are not necessarily being caused by your thoughts. They may be caused because the plane drops. And there's an automatic release of stress hormones anytime you feel like you're falling. So that they're two really difficult situations for people on an airplane. One is turbulence because, let me say, for example, suppose you're up on a stepladder painting the ceiling with a roller. If you lost your balance, doesn't matter how much you were focused on your painting, when you lose your balance, you're going to get zapped with stress hormones, and the stress hormones are going to grab your attention and make you worry about hitting the floor. So that's just one shot of stress hormones. Of course, your heart rate would go up a little bit. Your breathing rate would go up a little bit. But in the airplane, there's one drop after another drop after another drop, and you get one shot of stress hormones after another as a knee-jerk reaction. It's not caused by thoughts. It's just an automatic knee-jerk reaction of a part of the brain called the amygdala.
And on that thought, let's hold for a minute. We'll continue this in the next segment. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Captain Tom Bunn. He's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. And we'll be back with more of Captain Tom after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Teens in foster care will love you, even if you don't know the lingo.
Dad bod. Noun. The result of the occasional donut always washed down with confidence.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Captain Tom Bunn. He's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Captain Tom, before the break, you were talking about stress hormones and how they're released, and you were giving the analogy of being on a ladder painting, and all of a sudden the ladder starts shaking and you get a release of stress hormones, not because of the work that you're doing, but the fear of falling, basically. And then on a plane, this can happen a number of times. Let's talk more about this response.
Yeah, and we were, the context for this, we were talking about cognitive behavioral therapy and why it's not necessarily the thing that you can use for flying. Cognitive, the idea is that your feelings are caused by your thoughts. In this case, it's not about a thought. It's the dropping. And the thing that happens on the plane, you drop again and again and again, and you get bombarded with stress hormones. Now, one shot of stress hormones, a little increase in heart rate and breathing rate, but with 10 or 15 or 20 shots of stress hormones, you get a pounding heart and you get sweaty and you might even feel like you can't get your breath. And it's kind of hard in that situation to have a corrective thought such as, I'm sure everything's fine. It's just your body is telling you that you're about to die and you just can't counter that with, oh, I'm sure everything's fine. So what we had to do is to come up with a way to automatically prevent the release of stress hormones on one hand, and another part of the program to override the effects of the stress hormones. You see, because we have two parts of our, what we call the autonomic nervous system. And it's interesting, the first four letters, auto, A-U-T-O, it's supposed to work automatically. So we have the revving up part, and we have the calming down part. Think about your car. You've got the accelerator pedal to put more gas into the engine. Our revving up system puts more stress hormones in the brain and body to rev us up. The braking system is not hormonal. It's neurological. So what we're going to do to operate the braking system is we look for the thing that operates it, and that happens to be, because we're very social creatures, the face, the voice, and the body language or touch of another person who is sending us signals that we can relate to them safely because they're not a physical threat to us and they're not a psychological threat to us because they're not even judging us. That gives us maximum stimulation of the brake pedal. So we want to find someone in our life who has those characteristics, and we want to use that person to help calm us, to override stress hormones. But back to the stress hormones, how do we prevent the release of stress hormones? Nature has us wired up to not release stress hormones in certain situations having to do with reproduction in one way or another, such as when a mother nurses a child so that she can do that for quite some time without getting stressed, thinking that she should do something else, is she produces a hormone called oxytocin, shuts down her anxiety system. Oxytocin also causes bonding. So when you pick up a newborn child, it causes you to feel protective of the child. Of course, at the same time it does that, it also shuts down the fear system, but the purpose here is just to cause bonding. In sexual orgasm, males get oxytocin. Nature's trying to cause the male to be bonded to the female so that he sticks around in case there's a child that develops from this activity. With females, oxytocin is produced more during sexual foreplay so that the fear of getting physically close goes away. And then also with animals, when we have a pet, our pet looks at us like a lover does, like you're the only person in the world and I'm totally devoted to you. That produces oxytocin. And one more, if you get a long, steady hug for 30 seconds or so, that produces oxytocin. So we already talked about how we activate the calming system. This is about how we block the accelerator pedal with oxytocin. So we want to link that to the situations that a person could get into where they might have panic.
So we have this neuropharmacology, the production of oxytocin. But why are the medications that are prescribed for panic so ineffective and potentially dangerous?
Well, they're habit-forming, for one thing. And then as you take them, they become less effective and you have to take more. The other thing about them is they, in theory, they disconnect part of your emotional regulation system so that you don't have, your intellect is not doing as good a job helping you be calm as it might. So in terms of flying, what we find is that if you take meds for fear of flying, sooner or later, they're not going to help. But as you take them, they cause you to become more sensitive to the things that are troubling on the plane. So it's not helpful in that regard. the other thing about taking it for situations like bridges, tunnels, just day-to-day anxiety, MRIs, dentist's office, things like that, one of the problems there is that it takes twice as big a dose to stop panic as it does just to deal with anxiety. So it's a pretty large dose, and it could be very difficult to come off benzodiazepines once you've gotten addicted to them.
So you mentioned this response, the release of oxytocin in various basically physical contact situations. What about people who are afraid of touch?
Well, I don't know what to suggest except to look for maybe body language. Actually, I guess we could figure that in one hand we're talking about oxytocin production, and the other is we're looking to shut down the fear system with oxytocin. But the other thing is we're activating the braking system with the face, voice, and touch of another person. But instead of touch, it could be body language. The person is sending you signals through their body language that they're not a threat in any way.
So something that is calming, reassuring, loving, if for lack of a better word, would be the signal that the person is looking for.
Yeah. One of the things that I ask people when I'm going to introduce this method to them is I ask, do you have a friend who sometimes when you're with them, you felt your guard let down? And when you feel your guard let down, it's something that happens involuntarily. You can't consciously make it happen. It's happening because the signals you're picking up from the person you're with are telling you you're completely safe. So what you know if you're getting your guard let down is this is a good person to link your challenges to, because this is a person who has ability to give you the very best signals to activate your calming system. So, for example, we can link to situations that you're going to be into by saying, well, let's make it the MRI. Let's say you have to call and get a reservation. You have to get an appointment for the MRI. You might want to imagine you have a snapshot of a person doing that to kind of take it out of your own experience. And your friend is holding it by their face. So you link the safety signals from their face to make someone making a phone call to get an MRI. Then you want to link to the quality of their voice to it because there's calming signals there. So you look at the picture and you talk about it with your friend. And as you're talking about it, they give you a reassuring touch or body language, or they might even give you a hug if that's the kind of relationship you have. So that's how we activate the calming system. The way we would activate the oxytocin-producing system, we would say, link it to nursing your baby. Imagine as you nurse the baby, there's the photograph of making the reservation for the MRI, or when you hold a newborn child, someone is holding a photograph of a person making an appointment for an MRI by the baby. Or if it's a sexual afterglow moment, it sounds crazy, but you pretend that your lover is holding a picture by their face of a MRI appointment. And then you want to go to the next step, actually get in your car and going there. You want to link that up the same way, going into the check-in counter, going to the waiting room, changing into a gown, going into the place where the machine is, lying down, having the machine start operating, hearing the sounds, then 25% of the way through, 50% of the way through, 75% of the way through, and completely through. So we take the whole experience and break it down into pieces and link it to those two things, a memory of a time when you produce oxytocin, and a memory of being with a person whose face, voice, and touch calm you.
So the association could also be a place that you feel completely safe, perhaps a place that you've been on vacation, a very beautiful, comforting beach or a forest or someplace that you've been where you associate nature with that experience.
Well, I don't depend on that as much as another person. What you would find in a peaceful moment like lying on the beach or being in nature is you have a situation where there's nothing to bother you. What we're looking for is something that will actually calm you when there is something to bother you. For example, there was some research just out a couple of months ago from the University of Arizona. They took 102 people and they put them under some stress. Interesting, the stressor. They had them put 1 foot in 38-degree water, and they took their blood pressure and other signs while they were had their foot in the water to see what was going on there. So what they found is that the people who distracted themselves thinking about their day while their foot was in the water, they didn't get much benefit. People who had their significant other, a person they were in a romantic relationship with them present, got a lot of benefit. Their heart rate and blood pressure was down. But it also worked fine if you just remembered the person you had the relationship with. And that also works. So that's why, if you can remember a time in the past, in fact, the person doesn't even have to be alive anymore if you've been through the grieving process after they've passed away. You can take a person who was important to you, who's no longer alive, and link their face and their sound, their voice and their touch to the challenges that you deal with.
Now, absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Captain Tom Bunn, he's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Captain Tom, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Well, if you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and type in Panic Free, the book will pop up. Or you could go to the website, which is panicfree.net. And find information about the book, more than we've talked about here, as well as some places you can get it.
And you also have an association called SOAR. Tell us about that, please.
Well, we talked about the Fear of Flying program that that I worked with first at Pan Am and then set up my own. And I wanted to call it SOAR because, you know, people are so afraid of turbulence, but I've also seen birds use turbulence to go higher. So I wanted to call it SOAR. So I just looked for something that those letters would mean. So I called it Seminars on Aero Anxiety Relief. Anyway, it's at fearofflying.com. So we have a lot of free help there at fearofflying.com, some free videos, an app that's free. And if a person doesn't get enough help with that, then of course we have courses that they can enroll in.
And we'll be back with more of Captain Tom after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
This is OTR-FM. Part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give him a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve! It's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org, a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Captain Tom Bunn. He's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Captain Tom, what is the difference between anxiety and panic?
Well, as I see it, anxiety is something that we have conflict about. A part of us, we're multifaceted. A part of us wants to do one thing. Another part of us wants to do something different or not do that. So part of our anxiety is dealing with that conflict. In panic, let me back up a minute. So you see, there's a way out of the anxiety. You could do one of those things. What happens in panic is that you become anxious and you feel that it's life-threatening, not just a conflict. It's life-threatening. And secondly, you can't escape. You feel trapped. For example, if you start to have your heart pound, you might think that, I wonder if it's okay. You might say, I'm going to have it checked out. But a person who's more reactive might say, oh my goodness, I think I'm having a heart attack. And that's going to cause more stress hormones and more pounding heart. So it's going to exacerbate the symptom that they're having. And it's also going to make it difficult for their mind to have the mental balance to recognize the difference between something they're imagining and something that's real. And suddenly they are convinced they're having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing is, well, how can I get out of this situation? Well, you can't, because you can't run away from your heart. So you're trapped. Life-threatening situation and trapped. Those are the two main things that happen in a panic attack.
You know, it's interesting. I've been fortunate not to have suffered from any of the debilitating conditions we're discussing, but I can honestly share that when I was a younger man, I had a tendency to catastrophize situations only to find out how wrong I was on the other side. In other words, they were never as bad in reality as preconceived in my imagination. How dangerous mm-hmm. is a person's imagination?
Well, it depends on whether you believe it or not. And if you cause enough stress hormones to be released when you think about the bad thing happening, you begin to believe that it's going to happen. But I wanted to mention that something you might appreciate. The father of modern neurology, Donald Hebb, said that the more intelligent a person is, the more anxiety they are going to suffer. Why? Because the more things they can worry about. Mm. So congratulations, Victor.
I didn't think that worry was part of the multitasking I'd enjoy in this lifetime.
Well, that proves that you're intelligent, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. Now, let's discuss the word arousal. One normally thinks of this as describing sexual stimulation, but arousal also implies to panic. Are the mechanisms similar?
Well, the thing that this gets complex when we talk about sex, because they say there's a combination of arousal and downregulation. On one hand, you get arousal that causes you to become more energetic, but at the same time, you have this calming system kicking in to make you feel comfortable with the other person. So it's a combination of the two. It's like the accelerator pedal and the brake pedal being hit at the same time. But arousal normally is just the accelerator pedal revving you up, but it might be countered with a brake pedal in case you're getting too much arousal, too much speed in your car, you hit the brakes.
So let's apply arousal now to the concept of anxiety and panic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, first of all, when something happens that is not routine, or if something happens that's not expected, a part of the brain releases stress hormones to grab our attention. And this is useful. Perhaps, you might be focused on some task and not looking at the environment around you. Well, if something developed around you, not what you're focused on, where there's a danger, the amygdala might pick it up and then signal you through the release of stress hormones that you need to take a look at something it's come up with. So when the stress hormones are released, it grabs your attention. Ideally, you would first feel some alarm, but quickly downregulate that alarm to curiosity and look around and see, hey, okay, the amygdala's telling me something's going on here. What is it? Oh, I see what it is. Oh, that's nothing. Forget about it. Or, yeah, that's something I need to do something about. Let's take care of it. But what happens with people who have panic is they don't have that down-regulation system. When the amygdala fires off and causes them to have stress hormones and cause them to have alarm, a person who I just described would quickly calm down enough to be able to do a good job of making an assessment of the situation. A person who has panic, feels alarm, and stays alarmed, doesn't go down to curiosity, stays at alarm. And that clouds their ability to make an assessment about whether the thing that the amygdala is reacting to is a real danger or a false alarm.
You know, I find the neurology behind this fascinating. You mentioned the amygdala. Let's talk about the other parts of the brain and the other nerves that are involved in this process and how each of these reacts in these situations.
Well, the important one as far as calming us down is the vagus nerve. It is the longest nerve in the body. 80% of its activity is being sent to the heart, to the lungs to slow down, and to the gut to tell the gut that everything's normal so you don't need to get riled up and not do your job. 20% of what happens with the vagus nerve is feedback to the mind. But let me see if I can set the stage here. Let's say, suppose you are walking around someplace late at night and you're not sure if it's a safe neighborhood and something happens that frightens you. You're going to get a shot of stress hormones. You get put in what we call the fight or flight response. With this increase in heart rate and increase in breathing rate, you're supercharging your body to get ready to run or fight in case you need to. Now, you might not need to, but that's for you to decide intellectually. The amygdala is going to give you a warning that something might be wrong, but now you're supposed to consciously decide whether there really is something wrong or not. But you look at the other thing that happens. When you go into the fight or flight mode, you get the increase in heart rate and breathing rate to get you revved up for really strenuous physical activity, running or fighting. But look at this other thing that happens, nature does. It goes to the digestive system and says, look, hey, you just had a meal and, you know, you're digesting your food. Well, if your life is threatened, it isn't going to matter whether you digest your food or not. Let's shut down that digestive system and rob that blood supply and send it to the muscles so you can run or fight better. Okay, so that's part of the fight or flight situation. And you see, if you keep this fight or flight state for 20 or 30 minutes, you're going to start having GI problems because the digestive system's not working. Now, let's say we call the emergency off. The vagus nerve gets the signal that everything's clear. The heart rate goes down, the breathing rate goes down, and the signal goes to the gut. Okay, we had an emergency, folks. Let's go back to normal and digest your food.
And when we get that sensation, they talk about having butterflies or fluttering in the stomach. Is that what's taking place?
No. What I'm looking for is, in terms of the calming system, is that feeling of your guard letting down.
Mm. And what causes that butterfly effect?
That, I don't know. I was just thinking about it because I haven't given that any thought. I'm guessing it has something to do with the release of the stress hormones at a certain level. Some people get tingling. Some people get sweatiness. Some people get, you know, if you get enough stress hormones, sometimes people feel like they're disconnected from things, like there's a plate glass between them and reality. And some of us might even have an out-of-body experience, like under great stress you think of yourself as looking at yourself from outside. So there's a number of changes that can happen when stress hormones are released, if it's enough of them.
Now let's talk about your book. What is new and unique about the techniques you've developed and share in your book?
Well, what's really the most important thing is that we now know how to operate the calming system. That was something developed by a researcher, Stephen Porges. We know that the face, voice, and touch of another person is the thing that operates our calming system in an effective way. Yes, you can do breathing exercises. When you breathe out, that operates the calming system. But hey, you got to breathe back in, right? So that doesn't have as much potency as the face, voice, and touch of another person, which can have a lasting calming effect. So what we want to do that's important in this book is train your mind to operate unconsciously, to activate memory of a person's face, voice, and touch who's calming to you when you are in a challenging situation that could cause panic. And also, we didn't touch on this, but I wanted to. When you feel aroused in the next few days, just practice this exercise. Bring to mind the face, voice, and touch of another person. Let's say that you are in a room and something happens and you get stressed. Before you do anything about it, imagine your best friend walks in the door, says hello to you, and comes over and gives you a hug. Do you see what we're doing? We are taking high-level arousal or alarm, and you are going to intentionally bring to mind the three things that calm you, the face, voice, and touch. After you've done it a half a dozen times today and half a dozen times tomorrow and a half a dozen times the next day, it'll be an automatic program that every time you get revved up, you automatically get calmed down. You won't have to do it intentionally.
My guest this week is Captain Tom Bunn. He's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. We'll be back with more of Captain Tom after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for Inspired Conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired Conversations, to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Have you bought into the idea that you have to work hard for your money, that business is hard? I will share some dynamic access consciousness tools to get you out of your own way so you can create a business that actually succeeds. Join me, Simone Millicers, on The Joy of Business at 4 p.m. Mondays Eastern.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, and, of course, companionship. Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive, and now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance will come in with this group.
But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes. They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then, hey! The dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Looking for inspiration?
Want to be inspired?
Not sure where to go?
Find Mark and Kim every Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Inspired Living.
Topics will elevate consciousness and range from metaphysics to the human and social experience and all things spiritual.
Welcome to an inspired community that offers support, encouragement, and new ways of thinking. You are the inspired and the inspiration.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Captain Tom Bunn. He's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. So you had given an example of the technique that you employ in the book and that you share in your book. Give us another example of how it could apply. Let's say that I'm a person who has this real anxiety, panic, going through tunnels, driving through tunnels. What would you tell me to do to alleviate that, to work on that and get ready to go through tunnels?
Well, actually, that's an example I use right in the first part of the book. I had a client who I worked with on fear of flying. And something that might be of interest, too, is every Wednesday night we have a one-hour group phone session that people can join by going to fearflying.com and looking under talk and read and find the chat information, dial in and put in a code. So anyway, her name was Carol. She's a librarian down in Pennsylvania. And she was on the chat one night and said, "Hey, Tom, you know, can you use this stuff for tunnels?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, you know, since 9/11, I haven't, you know, I got to go out to Kennedy Airport and pick up some people, but I haven't been through the tunnel that comes out near the World Trade Center." She hadn't used it since 9/11. She'd been going all the way up to the George Washington Bridge. It takes, you know, a lot more time. So I said, "Okay, here's what you do. You get out some paper and you make a list of all the things that you're going to see on that trip. First of all, start with walking out your front door, and then two, getting in your car, going down the street, turning left or right, whatever it is, getting to the New Jersey Turnpike, going through various exits of the turnpike, and then getting off the turnpike to go to the tunnel, and then seeing the entrance of the tunnel, being 15% of the way through the tunnel, 30% through, 50%, 75% through, and then out on the other side, and take it a little farther toward Kennedy Airport. And then you want to also rehearse coming back through the tunnel, getting home." Now, in her case, she linked it to two things. She linked it to a memory of oxytocin production, and she linked it also to a memory of being with people who she felt very, very at home with. So what she reported back after she rehearsed this, so she built it into her unconscious procedural memory so it would work automatically for her. She wouldn't have to do anything at all on the trip. These landmarks, as she saw them, would bring the calming influences to mind automatically. So what she said was, on the way back from Kennedy Airport after she picked up her friends, they got into the middle of the tunnel. She said, "My worst nightmare happened. We got stuck for 30 minutes in the middle of the tunnel, and I was fine." So it works. Any situation that you can come up with where there's a sequence of events that's going to take place, you list them out, and you list them in a way that you're going to deal with them one at a time, and you take each one of them and link it to a friend's face, voice, and touch today, and then tomorrow you link it to an oxytocin-producing scene. If you nursed a child, that's the best one. It produces the most oxytocin. Pretend as you nurse the child, there's the picture of the New Jersey Turnpike entrance, for example, being held by someone as you nurse the baby. Or if you've held a newborn child, as you're holding the newborn child, someone's holding the photograph of the New Jersey Turnpike entrance by the baby. Now, or your sexual partner, just after making love, is holding those pictures by their face. Or during sexual foreplay, a person is holding the, it sounds really silly, I'm sorry, but for sexual foreplay, that particularly for females, there's oxytocin produced so that the fear system shuts down as far as getting physically close. And so you pretend that your lover is holding that New Jersey Turnpike photograph by their face.
Let's give our listeners some more examples of unconscious procedural memory. You had talked about driving a car as one example. Give us a couple of others.
Well, I can give you one from flying with airlines. The most hazardous things from a pilot's point of view that can happen is to have an engine fire, particularly on takeoff. And so what you do is you memorize this procedure, and then you go into the flight simulator, and you'll go rolling down the runway, and you don't know when this is going to happen, but you're going to hear a bell ring and a red light flashing, and then you have to go through the procedure. The first thing you do is you silence the bell. You push a button to silence the bell. And that kind of reminds me, you know, I mentioned how when we get a shot of stress hormones and get alarmed, the first thing we need to do is to get calmed down. The first thing we need to do when you, as a pilot, you have a fire, you have to get rid of that noise that's getting in the way of you working with the other pilot. And then the next thing you do is you put your hand on the throttle of the engine that you have a problem with. You don't want to say left or right engine, because that could be interpreted two ways when you say the right engine. You might say the correct engine, but you wouldn't say the right engine. And then the other pilot is going to acknowledge that you have your hand on the correct engine, and then you retard that to idle, and then you go to the fuel shutoff. You shut off the fuel supply to the engine. That alone will get rid of the fire in a few seconds, but you don't wait. You hit a button to discharge some fire extinguisher stuff into the engine nacelle area. Okay, so you do this again and again and again and again. So when you're on the airplane, if you should have an engine fire, you're just going to be able to carry it out on autopilot. Now, speaking of this, this is, you know, the 737 MAX airplane.
Yes.
There's been all this controversy about Boeing didn't build the plane right. I would have to say, from my opinion, there is nothing wrong with the airplane. It was the problem. Was inadequately trained pilots in third world countries. They are trying to operate so cheaply, they can't hire people who are really competent as pilots. Any pilot who's ever flown a Boeing in the United States has gone through the procedure to take care of that problem, even if it was back in the 1960s with the 707. There's just a two-step procedure. If your stabilizer trim is operating and it's not supposed to, how do you know it's not supposed to operate? Because you're not making it operate. If it's operating and you didn't make it operate, you just have these switches right under your thumb. You flick those switches and it stops it. And then you use your other hand to go over and flick off the power that goes to that motor. End of problem. It never becomes anywhere near a problem. Any qualified pilot can handle it in 3 seconds.
So it's a question of training.
It's a question of training, and you do it automatically. The problem is that these guys didn't know the procedures. They hadn't memorized it. They were trying to get out manuals to figure what they should do.
Your book says 10 days, a 10-day program to end panic. If this is that simple and can be taught with a book, why hasn't it been done before?
You know, I think we have worked so hard with cognitive solutions, and put a lot of faith in cognitive solutions. One reason is cognitive is a very brief therapy. Insurance companies might give you 5 or 6 sessions and that's it. You're expected to get the results in that period of time. But cognitive just doesn't work very well for panic, because when you are revved up, you can't deploy those cognitive skills. Now, if you could find a way to use cognitive that would use your unconscious procedural memory, if you used tried to change your thought, that would be helpful. But there's things that cause panic that are not really thought-based. There are reactions you get from the environment, or there's reactions you get from the physical changes in your body that can cause panic. It's not just thought that causes the trouble.
How effective is your method?
Well, with working with, actually, you see, I wasn't working about panic on the ground. I was working with people so that they could get on the plane without having panic. And people who ran through the course were roughly about 80% becoming panic-free in the airplane. And then if we worked on it, fine-tuned it with some phone sessions, it generally got pretty close to 100%. So I had actually thought that panic was being treated just fine with cognitive on the ground. But when I actually looked at the research, I was surprised to find that the research is based on response. That is, when you do cognitive therapy, 50% of the people respond. They get a little better. But I was really surprised to find that only 17% of the people treated by it actually become panic-free. So I thought, gee, we're doing 80% on an airplane, which is easily 80%, sometimes better. And that's a very difficult position. So if we can do that in an airplane, what about an easier situation just in day-to-day living? So that's what led me to do the book.
What would you like readers to take away from your book?
Well, the main thing is that no matter what you've tried, and it's probably been meds or cognitive. And by the way, both those two together only seem to do about 30% remission. So if you haven't gotten the results, and that would probably be 70% of people who tried to get some therapy or meds, we can fix it. And it can be done very quickly. And you don't have to have a therapist to do it. Just run through the procedures in the book.
We can fix it and fix it quickly. My guest, Captain Tom Bunn, he's the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Captain Tom, please tell our listeners one more time where you can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Just look for Panic Free on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or if you'd like to look at my website, panicfree.net.
And also, please, again, the SOAR program.
Fearofflying.com. That's going to be easy to remember. And if you want to join us on our Wednesday night chat, look across the top of the page at the headings, find the one that says talk and read, open it, and you'll see chat. That gives you the information you need to join us on the phone.
Captain Tom, once again, thank you for your service then and now, your continued service to all of us folks and who need to get this type of information. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Victor.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.